This video is sponsored by Simply Safe. There is no safe like Simply Safe. More on them later. Political violence in the United States is at an all-time high. That is some people wondering, is a civil war on the horizon?
41% of registered voters believe it's likely we see Civil War II within the next 5 years.
You don't trust the election officials.
Nope.
You don't trust the FBI.
Nope.
You don't trust the courts.
Nope.
Who do you trust?
Trump!
They hate the other side. The term that both sides use, one against the other, but they have this in common, is existential threat.
It's happened here before, and while a second civil war would look quite different from the 1860s, it's worth examining what brought us to the brink of a national divorce the first time to find out how close we really are to fighting our neighbors now. What would domestic combat look like in the modern era, and is it too late to turn back? Who'd be on each side of it if it did come to blows. This is what you could expect from a second U.S. Civil War. Roll the intro. Whether or not civil war is imminent, and don't worry, we will discuss, you might find yourself wondering about your own personal security. I personally watch way too many crime dramas and therefore find myself searching for some peace of mind. And I get that peace of mind from my partner on today's video, Simply Safe. Simply Safe's award-winning home security system provides comprehensive security for the whole home, with advanced sensors and cameras to detect threats from break-ins to fires, floods, and more. With 24/7 live guard protection, Simply Safe's expert agents act within 5 seconds of receiving an alarm signal, rapidly assessing the situation and taking immediate steps to ensure your family's safety. Professional monitoring plans are available for less than $1 per day, less than half the cost of traditional security systems. I've been using Simply Safe for years, so I was really excited when they reached out to partner with me today. I chose their home security system over all the others because of its flexibility and because of how easy it was to install myself. You can build in whatever security monitors make you feel best. I have an old house from the 1800s with tons of windows, so I was able to get a truly absurd number of entry sensors so that I know every window is secure. I also love their outdoor and indoor security cameras so I can keep an eye on my precious angel baby dog Moira even when I'm away. Via the smart alarm indoor camera, if there is an emergency, Simply Safe's agents can even see and speak to intruders in real time, which could stop them in their tracks. And with eyes on the scene, they can confirm the emergency and convey critical details to 911, helping to get a prioritized response. So get some peace of mind for yourself. Save 20% on your system and your first month is free when you sign up for Fast Protect monitoring at simplysafe.com/legia. There is no safe like Simply Safe. Thanks, Simply Safe. Liberals and conservatives don't like each other. Understatement of the century. And while some ideological friction is to be expected in any democracy, the deep emotional disdain between people on both sides is the most severe it's pretty much ever been. And though part of the blame certainly lies with our entrenched internet echo chambers, the slide toward extreme polarization kicked off in the 1980s with the invention of round-the-clock TV news coverage and Ronald fucking Reagan's work moving his party further to the right. But for the most part, even the folks mainlining Fox News day and night haven't jumped into violent action at this point. So mutual distrust and dislike alone do not a civil war make. But add nearly a decade of Trump and his allies normalizing not only violent rhetoric, but actual violence, and suddenly we're all eyeing each other up, wondering if armed conflict is imminent. And a note before we get too deep into this, my intention today is not to fearmonger you into civil war paranoia. We're talking hypotheticals here. But it is a less remote possibility than it once was, and I think it's important to examine the current climate and the direction we're headed in and what happened last time we were here, because learning from the past is essential to not repeating it, okay? Great. Civil war is on the tip of our tongues thanks to the looming election, rising political violence, and a new Hollywood film. A24's Civil War is ostensibly a solemn warning to Americans about the dangers ahead for our democracy. But while the film imagines a nation once again divided geographically, experts say a real-life civil conflict would be much harder to map. Today, despite rising political migration, where people are relocating based on their ideological leanings, even our bluest states have deep red enclaves and vice versa. And there's also the big scary looming question of the military. Which side would it take? Because spoiler alert, official control of the military will depend on who wins in November. We'll get into how various election outcomes could precipitate armed conflict later in the video. But first, I want to take a little deep dive into history, a little stroll down memory lane, to examine how it felt in the years leading up to the original Civil War and see how much of it resonates with what's going on today. The Civil War formally began on April 12, 1861, when Confederate soldiers attacked the Union base at Fort Sumter in South Carolina. But tension had been brewing between the northern and southern states for years before this, with political disputes often devolving into bloody confrontations. Starting in 1855, Kansas border ruffians, who you may remember from my video on political violence, wreaked havoc ranging from stuffing ballot boxes to slaughtering settlers, all to ensure that slavery could flourish and expand into the Western territories, flying in the face of federal policy. The ruffians were mostly poor white men whose political leaders routinely endorsed violence as a viable solution to their fear and hatred of Yankees, abolitionists, and black people. The Crime Against Kansas is an infamous speech delivered in 1856 by Republican Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts, in which the senator argued that those who would spread slavery to the new territories were working against the will of God. Once Sumner finished speaking, a Democratic congressman attacked him with a steel-tipped cane and proceeded to beat Sumner nearly to death on the floor of Congress. This was 5 years before the Civil War began and illustrates the heated feelings in Washington and the normalization of political violence in the country at the time. A senator felt emboldened to bludgeon another senator nearly to death over a political speech on the floor of Congress. But conflict wasn't limited to party versus party. Disagreement over the best way to preserve slavery led the Democratic Party to split itself in two ahead of the 1860 election. They literally held two separate nominating conventions and put up two different Democratic nominees, splitting the vote and allowing the election to be taken by Abe Lincoln, the first Republican ever elected to the White House. And once old Abe Lincoln was elected in November of 1860, the dominoes were quick to fall. By Christmas, the first state, South Carolina, had seceded from the Union. By March, the Confederate States of America had its own constitution and was gearing up for war. For the first couple years of the Civil War, all the fighting was done by volunteers. Union and Confederate soldiers both wholeheartedly believed they were the good guys, fighting nobly against downright demonic forces to protect their own cherished way of life. The American South controlled two-thirds of global cotton production, and the plantation owners building massive wealth on the backs of enslaved people didn't see any reason for that to change. Meanwhile, Northerners saw themselves as champions of the great American experiment. A Union fractured would be a Union failed. And look, for as much hand-wringing as goes on about modern information silos, at least our online bubbles are somewhat optional and self-imposed. Technically, nothing is stopping you from reading Breitbart articles or subscribing to the Daily Wire. But the 1800s? Not so many options. There were newspapers, political speeches, and books. So while Uncle Tom's Cabin and the Anti-Slavery Almanac persuaded countless Northerners to stand against slavery, those texts didn't circulate in the South in quite the same way. In addition to the volunteer soldiers being incredibly bought in ideologically, war was overall just a sexier concept back then. The Civil War was a call to adventure ordained by God himself, the ultimate test of manliness and virtue. Many would never have left their small towns had they not become soldiers or nurses. This was their main character moment, not to mention they only lived to like 30, so they didn't have a lot to lose. Anyway, the geographical aspect made the whole affair pretty much impossible to avoid, even if you really didn't want to go. It's not like you could just hang back while every other dude in town went off to fight. That social pressure also extended to the battlefield, where a man who shirked his duty in battle could literally never return home because embarrassing, you know? And while the whole, if you're not with us, you're against us mentality certainly maps onto modern politics, the tribal lines today are significantly murkier. On the one hand, we still love dehumanizing our opponents and imagining them as part of an evil monolith. On the other hand, rampant individualism and call-out culture have made both sides much less unified overall. It's hard to imagine the kind of infighting we see on social media translating into a successful war effort, you know? There's also the question of how many of us would actually be motivated to get off our comfy butts and fight. In the 1860s, it was common to see voter participation rates as high as 80%. For comparison, only about 66% of eligible voters participated in the 2020 presidential election, so only two-thirds of the country's eligible voters showed up in 2020, and it was still the highest rate for any national election since 1900. Still, the vitriolic rhetoric we see today shouldn't be underestimated. According to international relations scholar Rachel Kleinfield, political violence tends to be preceded by a dehumanization phase, followed by the normalization of violence against those dehumanized opponents. The dehumanization that took place during the first Civil War was so vicious and so all-consuming that Yankee and redneck stereotypes persist to this day, 160 years and many generations later. Today, Americans harbor a strong dislike for members of the opposing political party. This emotional polarization, also known as affective polarization, while severe, is on par with the levels seen in many European countries whose democracies are suffering similarly to ours. While affective polarization in the US has been rising for decades, political violence didn't spike until 2016. So hating one another doesn't necessarily cause violence, but it does contribute to an environment in which we'll more readily accept violent rhetoric from our politicians, which in turn results in violence by bad actors. As we've discussed before on this channel, political leaders have immense power to ease polarization and diffuse violence. So while it's technically a good sign that our elected officials haven't started physically attacking each other on the floor of Congress, studies have shown that people are significantly more likely to engage in political violence when their representatives are endorsing it, even just verbally. And boy, howdy, have they been endorsing it.
I love the old days. You know what they used to do to guys like that when they were in a place like this? They'd be carried out on a stretcher, folks.
Democrats want Republicans dead, and they've already started the killings.
The militant left wing in our country has become the enemy within.
And because of this, secession is once again starting to sound pretty appealing to some people. But while it's fun to fantasize about turning California into a liberal utopia or sending all the MAGA loyalists to Texas, that's probably not going to happen. The Constitution doesn't afford any locality the right to secede from the Union. If it did, we wouldn't have needed a civil war to begin with. Still, secession supporters like president of the pro-secession Texas nationalist movement, Daniel Miller, no relation, argue that states can secede because it's not explicitly prohibited by the Constitution. Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution lays out everything states can't do. So they claim anything not on the list isn't technically forbidden. Although it might be because, I don't know, the framers of the Constitution thought it would be pretty obvious that states couldn't willy-nilly come and go as they pleased and they didn't have to spell that out. Or it could be that they were humans and not in fact all-knowing God, so they just forgot to include it. Seems like a stretch to say the framers of the Constitution of the United States of America definitely were like, oh yeah, states can secede whenever, that's fine. But sure. Anyway, if the Civil War proved anything, it was that we're pretty committed to the whole united part of United States. It's safe to assume that anyone calling for a national divorce as a constitutionally legitimate solution is just peacocking or trying to deepen the divisions that benefit them politically, or they just generally might not know the law. So the country feels hopelessly polarized. But according to a recent brief from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, American voters are actually less ideologically disparate than we tend to think. Like, our beliefs generally are not that far apart. For example, many Democrats and Republicans support creating a federal database to track gun sales, but they disagree about how urgent the issue is. 73% of Democrats consider gun violence a major problem versus 18% of Republicans. While we may feel the other side is out to get us and we fundamentally disagree on everything, the truth, as I've said multiple times on this channel, is that we actually have more in common than we think. One impetus behind this belief that we're diametrically opposed when the reality is that we're not, is that ever more ideologically extreme politicians have been running for office since the 1980s when the Christian nationalist movement first slithered its way inside the walls of the conservative establishment and discovered that they can win elections by playing into the basest fears of the electorate. By 2012, Republican Party chairs at the county level were electing 10 extreme candidates for every one moderate, while Democrats picked 2 extreme candidates for every 1 moderate. And more extreme candidates have brought more extreme policies, and with it, a seething resentment on both sides. How could you ever support an abortion ban? How could you ever support baby murder? You hate women. God hates you. You know the drill. And these more extreme stances being held by these politicians do not represent the majority of Americans. But because they're the loudest, most scandalous voices in the room, it gives the perception that those who identify on the right or on the left are more extreme than ever. Interestingly, the more politically engaged a person is, the more likely they are to overestimate the gap between themselves and their opponents. This misconception is most severe among progressive activists, followed closely by extreme conservatives. But though affective polarization is pretty symmetrical across parties, we hate each other about the same amount, the political violence comes overwhelmingly from the right. Between 1994 and 2020, there were 411 right-wing domestic terrorist attacks versus 219 left-wing ones. And while for right-wing extremists, abortion-related targets were most common in the first decade of data, between 2015 and 2020, the majority of targets, 42%, were private individuals, followed by religious institutions at 32%, and finally, government, military, or police locations at 8%. On the left, targets have also shifted over time. Between 1994 and 2009, most left-wing targets were businesses, universities, or labs tied to animal rights or environmental violations. Since 2015, there's been more action around anarchism and anti-fascism, with 36% of left-wing political violence targeting government, military, and police facilities and personnel. In the past decade, right-wing extremists were responsible for the vast majority of extremist-related murders, while left-wing extremists were more likely to victimize property. These patterns are important because a civil war would most likely start with factions from the political extremes targeting one another more directly. Unlike the original Civil War, which involved two geographically and ideologically defined sides in a formal fight over governance, the goals of a modern civil conflict would be much less clear. Is the goal secession and the formation of a new country? A coup of the U.S. government? It probably wouldn't be clearly established. People are more spread out and not as clearly geographically divided. There are likely people in rural Minnesota who would take up arms with people from rural Texas on the same side of the conflict, but separated by hundreds of miles. And people's ideologies are hyper-specific and often unified over internet forums that, within themselves, experience a lot of infighting. In my incel video alone, I identified something like 5 different types of men who hate women and talk about it online, and have adopted different ideologies and strategies for expressing that hatred that, amongst themselves, they take very seriously. That siloing and hyper-specificity of grievances makes the divide far less clear. Of course, things were complex and not cut and dry in the pre-Civil War 1850s, but the geographical divides and lack of far-reaching communication made things a little simpler than they would be in our hypothetical modern-day Civil War. So that's why we're starting with far-left and far-right domestic terrorists. These are more easily defined categories of people who are more likely than most to be willing to take up arms. In general, people who commit political violence have aggressive personalities and low self-control. Another key ingredient, they need to believe they won't face severe consequences, often through political leaders directly condoning the violent behavior or even simply failing to condemn it. The Carnegie Endowment report I mentioned before identifies 2 main types of people most likely to engage in a second civil war: so-called activist mavericks on the left and members of the anti-democratic right. Activist mavericks are so far left in their ideology that, while despising Republicans, they also don't support Democrats. They believe that America hasn't yet achieved democracy and that political violence is a valid means to achieve greater racial and democratic representation. 60% of these so-called activist mavericks support property crime, and 28% support violence against other people. They're most often male and younger and wealthier than average Americans, but people whose identities put them at a greater risk of being on the receiving end of violence also make up part of this group. The anti-democratic right, on the other hand, is characterized by high distrust, a low sense of agency, and strong feelings of grievance and victimhood. A 2022 study found that individual beliefs in Christian nationalism translated into support for political violence when bolstered by white identity, perceived victimhood, and support for the QAnon movement. We covered the plague that is Christian nationalism in my video about how the religious right ruined everything, so I'll just give you a quick refresher. Christian nationalists, who've been gaining political prevalence since when else? The 1980s, thanks Reagan, have 3 key beliefs. The belief that the U.S. was founded as a Christian nation and that separations between church and state should be eliminated. A recent survey found that more than half of Republicans believe the U.S. should be a strictly Christian nation. That's 54% of Republicans who either adhere to or sympathize with Christian nationalist views.
Yikes.
Yeah? Yikes. A belief in a warrior Christ, as depicted in the Book of Revelation. This version of Jesus wears a robe dipped in blood and leads the armies of heaven in the ultimate battle against evil. Trump has become a Christ-like figure for many in this movement, who are super on board with his end times rhetoric and his open invitation to bring on the reckoning. The belief that there's such a person as a real American. When white Christian nationalists claimed the 2020 election was stolen, they were laying bare their belief that some votes or voters shouldn't count. The real Americans voted for Donald Trump, i.e. white people. And Biden only won because of, yes, ballot stuffing and fraud, but also because the votes cast for him weren't cast by real Americans, i.e. they were cast by immigrants, left-wing operatives, people who don't believe in the true spirit of America, whatever that means. These core beliefs are all animated by a feeling of being under attack. For starters, it's a lonely-ish time to be a Christian fundamentalist. In 2021, U.S. church membership fell below 50% for the first time ever. On top of the stress of being surrounded by heathens, these folks are also panicked about how many brown people are moving in. Already, the majority of Americans under 18 today are non-white. It's a stressful time to be an evangelical white supremacist, okay? All that said about extremists on the right and left, violence is still being committed by a proportionately tiny minority of people. For tensions to escalate into anything that would qualify as a civil war, both sides would need to see significant swells in participation from folks who'd much rather keep their heads down and steer clear of these types of entanglements. Think about how terrified of right-wing violence you personally would have to be to go out and buy a gun or learn to make a pipe bomb. Imagine how close the threat would need to feel for you to literally take up arms and fight. The level of paranoia and distrust would have to be all-consuming. And hey, some people are already there, and I'm not discounting the fact that for some people, especially those whose identities make them daily targets of hatred and bigotry, the threat is imminent. Faced with rising aggression from the right, educational organizations like the Socialist Rifle Association have formed to help progressives learn to keep and use firearms. For reference, people on the left are less than half as likely to own a firearm as people on the right.
I bought my first gun. It was a shotgun 10 days after January 6th. I was terrified that, you know, there's gonna be like an armed militia at the grocery store and like, my child is non-binary. They hear me say they, them, or whatever. And, you know, so they just total, like, you know, this essence of paranoia.
Rob and I want to make sure that, like, that there is pushback against this kind of shit. That, like, trans people have a right to live.
In his 1970 book, Why Men Rebel, Tim Gurr explores why people engage in political violence and how regimes respond. Frustration, he writes, only boils over into violence when there's a discrepancy between what people think they deserve and what they actually think they can get. Many other variables influence the use of violence as well, including the culture, the society, and the political environment. According to Gurr, the culture must at least accept, if not approve, of violent action as a productive means to an end. Political violence is also more likely if the current leadership or political system is seen as illegitimate. All these factors were at play for the January 6th insurrectionists. And if Trump returns to office, those tendencies are likely to flourish. Periods of power transfer or regime change are moments of vulnerability for any administration, and the 2024 election could be a real doozy. Did you know on Patreon you can get early access to these videos ad-free? Thank you to my Patreon community and my YouTube members for supporting the research and work that goes into these videos. Consider checking out my Patreon community or clicking the big join button below to become a member here on YouTube. You'll be supporting my work and getting access to early, ad-free, uncensored versions of all of these videos, as well as access to my research and all my sources, exclusive live streams, and more. Your support helps to keep these videos free for everyone and further our mission towards legal and political education for all. I mentioned earlier that whichever side the military takes would pretty much determine the outcome of any civil conflict. That's because the US remains the world's dominant military power, and it's not even close. Last year, we spent more than the next 10 countries combined on our armed forces. And though the US military has been struggling to recruit new members, and its number of active duty personnel has fallen by 39% since 1987, we've still got more than 2 million people enlisted. 2 million people in, oh yeah, a fuck ton of weapons. If Biden wins in November, we can probably expect more of the same. Our armed forces will continue serving as self-appointed world police and meddling in foreign affairs in ways the American people don't support. Extremism, which is already prevalent among service members, would continue to proliferate. One Military Times poll from 2020 reported that more than half of minority service members say they have personally witnessed examples of white nationalism or ideologically driven racism within the ranks in recent months. We've already seen examples of soldier-on-soldier political violence, like the radicalized private who plotted an attack on his own unit, or the four U.S. Army soldiers who formed their own militia and then killed a recently discharged soldier so he couldn't tell anyone about their plans to assassinate then-President Obama and overthrow the government. Rates of right-wing extremism among the people our government has trained to use weapons are truly alarming. Because beyond active duty, you've got thousands of veterans who found community and comfort in right-wing extremist groups and militias. A troubling number of domestic terrorist attacks have been committed by people our own government has trained in combat. Remember Timothy McVeigh, the domestic terrorist who killed 168 people by detonating a car bomb in front of a federal building in Oklahoma City in 1995? He was an ex-soldier. Stuart Rhodes, founder of the far-right group The Oath Keepers, who was convicted for seditious conspiracy for his role in the January 6th insurrection, former Army paratrooper. Stephen Carrillo, member of the so-called Boogaloo Boys, an extremist group explicitly committed to igniting a civil war, shot one security officer to death and critically wounded another in 2020. Carrillo was an Air Force staff sergeant. A recent New York Times report estimated that around 25% of militia members come from a military background. And while that doesn't mean that militias are therefore prepared to take on the U.S. government, it means they're less unprepared than would be ideal for me personally. If Trump gets a second term, the lines between far-right militia and the official military would probably get real muddy real fast, similar to how the lines between the military and the police force are already muddy as hell. According to an analysis by The Guardian in 2022, hard-right organizations have now infiltrated so many police forces that they have become unreliable allies in the struggle against domestic terrorism.
Hey, y'all cops, why is somebody dying in here? Come do your job. Come do your job. You come do your job.
Police did not intervene to break it up.
The Unite the Right rally in 2017 brought hundreds of white supremacists and Antifa counter-protesters to Charlottesville, Virginia. And though Antifa, also known as Black Bloc protesters, have been characterized as violent agitators keen on instigating conflict, they tend to see themselves differently.
I do feel vulnerable and I do feel scared every day, but that's why I'm in the block. It's important that we don't give the state a monopoly on violence.
Reminder that Antifa is comprised of hyper-local groups and is not a unified organization with central leadership. So again, the fantasy of an all-out civil war with two distinct sides organizing against one another is highly unlikely. More probable would be localized pockets of violence in highly polarized areas, the kinds of conflicts we've been seeing in Portland, for example, for years. It's both one of the most progressive cities in the nation and surrounded by deep red rural Oregon. It's a haven for progressives and an easy target for right-wing extremists looking to pick a fight. But what would that fighting actually look like in this hypothetical second civil war compared to the first one? According to a 2011 analysis of freshly digitized census data, as many as 850,000 people may have died during the Civil War. But even going by the previous estimate of 620,000 casualties, the Civil War was the deadliest conflict in American history, with more American lives lost than either World War I or World War II. Which is jarring, but also makes sense because Americans were on both sides of the Civil War, so every single death was technically an American. Anyway, the fighting began in the traditional style, with rows of men marching towards one another across a battlefield, a little drummer boy in the back announcing their arrival. But by the end, things had devolved into what the Union's General Sherman called total war, a slash-and-burn, guerrilla-style approach that ushered in a brand new era of deadly conflict. A few factors contributed to this transition, most of them technological. We'll run through them and then talk about what the contemporary counterparts might be. Weapons. Firearms, a new type of musket and bullet, the mini-ball, were directly responsible for the unprecedented carnage of the American Civil War, offering improved accuracy at a range of over 600 yards and 8 times faster to reload than old models. By the time either side got close enough to see their opponent, limbs were already flying off in every direction. A fun-ish fact, I guess, more soldiers became amputees during the Civil War than in any other American conflict. 60,000 people. Communication. Photography. Though cumbersome and ill-equipped for action shots, still photographs depicting the carnage of every battle seared the war into the collective consciousness on both sides. Newspapers also played an important role in stoking troop morale, reiterating the nobility of the soldiers' sacrifice and reinforcing every foul stereotype they'd come to believe about the men on the other side. The telegraph. Invented in 1837, with Morse code following close behind in 1844, the telegraph made it possible to communicate across hundreds of miles in real time. So while President Lincoln spent a great deal of his time camped out in the War Department waiting for click-click-tippity-taps of intel from the front lines, General Lee, head of the Confederate Army, was stuck waiting for news the old-fashioned way. Messages were delivered in months, not moments, on horseback across hundreds of miles. General Lee was considered one of the finest military strategists alive at the time. Ultimately, however, he simply lacked the infrastructure required to beat the Union. Which brings us to railroads. Railroads were an essential weapon for the North. Lincoln could deploy 25,000 troops in less than a week by rail. The same journey would have taken 2 full months on horseback. The North had some 24,000 1,000 miles of rail track laid by the time the Civil War began. The South only had about 9,000 miles worth. And while Lincoln was quick to strike deals with Northern Railroad owners to co-opt the trains for military use, the Southern tracks remained under private control for the duration of the Civil War. In 1864, eager to hasten the war's end, Union soldiers bent Southern rail tracks so Confederate troops couldn't get supplies or reinforcements. Things got even uglier after the torching of Atlanta, which was closely followed by General Sherman's March to the Sea. 62,000 Union soldiers crossed the state of Georgia, waging total war along the way, sacking villages, killing civilians, torching crops, destroying anything of potential military value. A few months later, on April 9th, 1865, General Lee surrendered. Okay, so how might a civil war play out today? First and foremost, we shouldn't expect such clear-cut start and end dates because, again, we'd probably have many overlapping groups fighting different targets simultaneously, and nothing would feel remotely organized about it. But one thing's for sure, you'd see a lot of AR-15s. Weapons, AR-15s, breaking news, Americans love guns. A 2020 report from the National Shooting Sports Foundation estimates that there are around 434 million firearms in civilian possession in the U.S. right now. That's 1.3 guns per person. Explosives and firearms have been the top weapons of choice for far-right and left-wing extremist attacks. But gun violence has proven the most deadly by far. Firearms were used in 9 of the 11 fatal left-wing attacks since 1994, and 73% of right-wing ones. And no firearm is quite so popular in the U.S. as the AR-15. It's the best-selling rifle in the country, and more than 20 million of them are currently in circulation. The vast majority have never been used to commit murder, but the vast majority of mass murderers have used AR-15s. They're lighter and easier to operate than a lot of other firearms, so much so that some people even call them the beginner's rifle, which feels super counterintuitive because they look so much more serious than a pistol, for example, but pistols actually require much more serious handlers. AR-15s are also highly customizable, making them appealing for people with nefarious intentions. For example, the Las Vegas shooter modified his AR-15 to shoot continuously from his 32nd floor suites in the Mandalay Bay Hotel, killing 60 people and wounding more than 400. Drones. Drones have proven to be essential weapons in Ukraine's resistance against Russia. Using nothing more than cheap aerial drones, they've created homegrown military systems with the flexibility to both gather intelligence and to carry out bomb attacks. Granted, you can't buy these on Amazon, but the company that makes a popular model is based in Virginia. So I'm just assuming that in a second U.S. Civil War scenario, drones would make it into the mix. Biological warfare. First, let me just make it clear that biological agents have only been used as terrorist weapons in 0.2% of all historic terrorist attacks on Earth. But even though they're extremely rare, biological attacks are still very much a threat. Nuclear weapons have also been used really sparingly because their consequences are not only widely devastating, but can easily backfire. And it takes a lot more skill to procure a nuclear bomb or a package of anthrax than it does to order an AR-15. Only 21 terrorist attacks involving biological agents were recorded in the U.S. between 1970 and 2019. And 10 of those were anthrax-related incidents in 2001. Worldwide, ricin, salmonella, fecal matter, botulinum toxin, and HIV have all also shown up in at least one bioattack during the period between 1970 and 2019. Railroads, cyber war edition. Today, instead of ripping out tracks, the preferred method of train sabotage is cyber attack. On a timeline of significant cyber incidents compiled by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a leading national security think tank, railroad systems were targeted by hackers in Romania, Lithuania, Denmark, Ukraine, Poland, Brazil, and Israel. I'm just gonna say it, shutting down entire transit systems does not seem difficult enough to do. Communication, surveillance. At this point, I think most of us have resigned ourselves to the idea that nothing we do in cyberspace is private unless we've taken rigorous steps to ensure that's the case. So for example, even though social media empowers us to share on-the-ground images and information, which is awesome, it also exposes us to surveillance. You could expect to see more coded language on social media. So instead of people just using the watermelon emoji instead of typing out Palestine, they might construct entirely coded sentences to avoid getting shadow banned. And the platforms themselves aren't the only ones watching. At the end of April of this year, the FCC fined AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, and Verizon almost $200 million for illegally sharing customers' location data. We literally have tracking devices in our pockets, and I suspect analog communications would likely become back in fashion as well. Middle school style, just passing notes. I think you could also reasonably expect to see more doxing and swatting campaigns like the swarm of attacks on political figures last December. Disinformation, meaning incorrect information that is spread with the intention of misleading people, would only get worse in a civil war scenario. The danger is especially high for people with low media literacy, like the majority of American adults. But fake news, which you may recall has already caused some significant turmoil for a little democracy, now has an evil robot twin. We talked about AI-generated robocalls in my video about whether AI is good for democracy in the context of fake calls misinforming voters about polling details. But imagine if one of those robocalls told you to shelter in place because an active shooter was running through your neighborhood, or the AI spoofed your mom's voice and called you begging for ransom. Even if you realized it wasn't true, that kind of emotional terrorism would quickly shed any modicum of safety in your nervous system, because these tactics have a potent ability to disrupt people's sense of safety both inside their homes and in public spaces. Paranoia and fear could grow exponentially with each individual incident. As that pressure compounded, people who never imagined taking up arms might find themselves motivated to fight. But to what end? The most likely outcome I can imagine if we continue down our current path is that we end up so polarized that we start to see turf wars break out, mafia style, in areas with the starkest political contrasts in the closest proximity. Places like Portland, Oregon, Austin, Texas, and Asheville, North Carolina, I could imagine militarized liberal forces taking an even more organized role in protecting its people. That's the kind of long-term conflict we might see, even if Biden stays in office. Again, if Trump wins and gets control of the military, it's probably game over. So really, step one in avoiding civil war is making sure Trump doesn't get a second term. So please make sure your voter registration is up to date, all right? Thank you so much. So yes, that's all bleak, but we're not necessarily completely doomed. Here's what we could choose to do instead that may help turn the tides. I've said it before, and I'll say it again, and it made a lot of you mad. We have to start talking to Republicans. I made a whole video about it. Go watch that after this. But you don't even need to start there. In fact, you shouldn't start there. That's like step 12 advanced level shit. First, we have to change the way we think about our political opponents. Because the more we dehumanize one another, the harder it gets to communicate or find any common ground. The less we trust each other, the closer we get to violence. You might find it helpful to sample some right-wing news sources every once in a while to get a bit more of a bird's-eye view of how the media is high-key manipulating all of us at all times. About 2 years ago, the idea of another civil war trended briefly in left-wing media after political scientist Barbara F. Walter wrote a book on the subject. On the right, a new poll from one bunk source or another comes out every few years using leading questions and participation bias to exaggerate and escalate the threat of civil war. All that to say, our silos aren't keeping us safe. And I know that you're like, Legia, but the Republicans are the worst, and I feel you. So just remember that you can start teeny tiny by experimenting with empathy in the comfort of your own mind. Is there a world where if you sit and think for a while, you might be able to understand why someone in, I don't know, let's just say rural Virginia, whose mining job has been eliminated by the EPA policies, or whose small business can't stay afloat because they keep having to pay taxes, and yet they don't see any benefit to those taxes because it's all going to fight foreign wars, might think that the answer is actually that the government is bad and the people who went to fancy Ivy League schools and want to increase their taxes are out to get them. You might not agree with their conclusions, but you can at least empathize with how they got there. And if you get to the point where you're feeling resilient and ambitious, there are organizations that can help you take things further. Braver Angels is the largest cross-partisan volunteer-led movement in the country dedicated to bridging the gap between liberals and conservatives. They offer online courses, debates, workshops, a podcast, and even an in-person conference. Just by existing, groups like Braver Angels prove that the most important thing two people need to have in common is a willingness to hear each other out. And yes, there are some people, many of them white Christian nationalists, who aren't just misunderstood and who are fully committed to their bigotry. Nobody is blaming you for saying fuck those guys. This isn't about them. And you shouldn't have to argue for your basic humanity anyway. They're a minority that is too far gone for meaningful conversations. This is about the 83% of American adults who don't identify as Christian nationalists. That's more than 215 million people. You might be surprised to find we have more in common than we think, and fewer people are too far gone than you might imagine. For me personally, it's worth a shot, given that we're only getting more polarized in this country, and if we keep heading in the direction that we're heading, the outcome seems pretty damn bleak. Shout out to my newest supporters on Patreon and on YouTube, as well as supporters in my royal tiers, and a very special shout out to my multi-platinum supporters, T, Latranger Lucas, Joshua Cole, Thomas Johnson, Sophia Sams, Anthony Giles, and Brett Piontek. Your generosity makes this channel what it is, so thank you. If you like this video, you'll also enjoy this series where I practice humanizing the people I disagree with by reacting to alt-right TikToks. Thanks so much for watching. Have a good day. Bye-bye.